Welcome to those arriving today. Welcome to those returning again to this Rohatsu Sesshin celebrating Buddha's great awakening. This Sesshin we're looking at celebrating the Buddha's great awakening through the Buddha's story of the Buddha's great awakening. And a little kind of compare and contrast to Dogen's story of great awakening. We're looking at this issue of enlightenment or awakening. So the more we get into it, the more it seems like it's not so clear-cut. It's in this long-standing 2,500-year-old tradition we're practicing in, it looks like actually the understanding of awakening or enlightenment evolved quite a bit over time. And we honor all our Buddhas and ancestors. So that's why we start with Shakyamuni Buddha's story. In his own words, from the old sutras, the Pali Canon, we heard how the Buddha realized everything that he was searching for in his life was subject to birth, old age, sickness, and death. And he decided that he would go on a noble quest for the supreme security from bondage, nirvana, which he described in the sutra as that which is not subject to birth, old age, sickness, and death. The unborn, the unaging, the unailing, the deathless. And he went and found some teachers which were available in India in his time. And he was a good student. He learned what they taught, was able to speak about what they taught, and then thought, I actually should realize what they taught. Was able to realize what they taught. They invited him to actually... One teacher said, join me in leading the community. The next teacher actually said, actually, why don't you lead the community now? But with both of them, this bodhisattva said, it's pretty great what I've realized here, but I think there's more to it. And he moved on. This is where we left off. The Buddha says, Buddha to be says, still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country, until eventually I arrived at Uluvela near Sananigama, present day, what we call Bodh Gaya. Magadha is like the area of northern India, like now Bihar and Uttar Pradesh. Why he stopped exactly here, we don't know. It seems like we don't know how much time has passed since he left these two teachers, but But this whole period, we later hear in the scriptures, from the time that he left home to the time he sat down under the Bodhi tree and realized great awakening was 6 years. So he's a foot-traveling monk, exploring lots of different yogic traditions and practices and not stopping with any one of them. Now, he's explored a lot, he's learned a lot from his teachers, and now he's going off on his own. There, at Uruvela, Bodh Gaya, I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. Like, there's a village nearby to beg for some food, but it's a quiet, delightful grove for meditation. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a person intent on striving, he thought. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving, the noble quest. Now in Zen, we striving sometimes gets kind of a bad rap, especially, I think, Soto Zen. I don't know what they're translating here as striving. But diligence and great effort doesn't get such a bad rap. So this is now the beginning of story gets kind of gruesome. Right? This is the Buddha starts practicing these austerities and ascetic practices. And as I reflect on this, I wonder what was going on there, if this is really how the Buddha told it, because he learned these really sublime, very peaceful meditative states of consciousness called the base of nothingness and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Very peaceful, very still, very blissful and free from suffering. The drawback was that they were conditioned states, and therefore they were states of mind that were born and died, and he was looking for the unborn and the deathless. But after that, to go into this like very unpleasant self-mortification kind of practice is kind of surprising to me. It would make more sense if he tried that first, I think, and then got into these peaceful ones. So if I had to imagine, I would just say that he probably felt he was on the right track with these meditative absorptions. They're pretty good, but he was just so diligent and so intent on his goal that he was just willing to try anything, any method or practice. And I think these practices that he starts trying, he didn't make them up. These were in ancient India, they knew these meditative absorptions, but they also knew all these austerities and ways to, we might say, manipulate the body and mind into different states of consciousness. Even in modern India, these people still practice. I think these first of these practices we could call pranayama. He was using the breath. And in modern yoga, in Santa Cruz, people take pranayama classes. They might be a little different than this. But pranayama is all about ways of using the breath to kind of control the mind, prana is like the subtle energy related to the breath, and ayama is actually, I think, means something like to control. Does anyone know that one? So here's the Buddha's description. First of all, this is before the pranayama. First, I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. And we don't know exactly what he means, but we might imagine that, like, all these conditioned thoughts that are arising in this mind, if I'm looking for the unconditioned, I better stop them. I have to find a way to stop these conditioned experiences, thoughts, and also feelings. What if I just, like, block them out? It might be what he means by crush mind with mind. In this very forceful, effortful way with gritting my teeth, right? So, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, crush him, so too, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. But although tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and strained because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. It was very unpleasant, but it was okay. It didn't overcome me. So, yeah. As you hear this, I think you all know that the Buddha's going to get over this kind of stuff later, right? He's going to say, this is not quite the way, but he tried it. I think it's like he was willing to try anything. I thought, now here comes the pranayama. Suppose I practiced the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth and nose. While I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. Just as there's a loud sound when a smith's bellows are blown, so too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my nose and ears, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and strained because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. Remember, the winds were like coursing through his ears in the previous. Now I'm going to stop, block my ears too. While I did so, violent winds cut through my head. And so on. This was very painful. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose, and ears. And while I did so, there were violent pains in my head, like a person tightening a tough leather strap around my head and a headband, so too, there were violent pains in my head from this practice. Although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and strained because I was exhausted by the painful striving, but such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So, he continues. Somewhere in that area of Bodh Gaya, when Yarrow and I and others were in Bulgaria a few years ago. Ken and Rachel and our big pilgrimage we did there. The current story is that it's this kind of like mountain, kind of out, not really mountain, but like rocky crags, the outcrop in the middle of the vast flat plain of the Magadan region. And in this outcrop, there's a cave, and they say that's where the Buddha practiced these austerities. But it's about 3 to 5 miles from the Bodhi tree. It's a few miles. You can see it from the Bodhi tree across the plains, this one kind of mountain outcrop, and you can go up and sit in the cave. So that's today's episode. Since we're looking at this issue of enlightenment, which those who didn't hear it, enlightenment is a term coined by one Max Müller in the 1800s, a German scholar of Indian philosophy, who translated Bodhi as enlightenment, and it really stuck. I just see, like, all these chants that we do here. Now I'm noticing enlightenment is, that word is just in almost every one of the chants that we do during service. So he seems to be translating Bodhi in Sanskrit, which I think awakening is a more accurate translation. And also then people like D.T. Suzuki picked up on this word enlightenment and used it to translate Satori and Kensho in Japanese. So someone asked via note, what is the difference between Satori and Kensho? These are Japanese Zen terms. It seems that, again, it's not so clear-cut. Sometimes they're used interchangeably. They're both often translated as enlightenment or awakening or some deep insight into how things are. But I would say we could nuance it a little bit if we had to nuance a difference. And I've heard other people try to nuance it like this. Kensho means literally seeing nature. And nature is kind of abbreviation for Buddha nature, our true nature. And I haven't heard this before, but it occurs to me, and we could try researching this, but I'm willing to bet on it, that the origin of this term Kensho is the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which we studied this fall. Because in that sutra is the first sutra around 200 or 300 of the Common Era to use this term Buddha nature. And in that sutra, there is the phrase, multiple times, phrase, seeing Buddha nature. I think it's Ken Busho in the Chinese version of the sutra. Seeing Buddha nature. And then that gets abbreviated to just seeing nature. And in the sutra, the Buddha speaks of it as like, Bodhisattvas can see this Buddha nature in a little bit of a hazy way. It's not totally clear for them. They see it, but like in sort of through the mist. And Buddhas see Buddha nature very clearly, like broad daylight. So then later in China, I think the term Kensho in Zen really originated with the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, another classic Zen text where Daikan Eno Daiyosho, our ancestor, says, it's just a matter of seeing your nature. This business of practice and enlightenment in this new movement called Zen. The sixth ancestor was still in what was considered the birth of Zen, this new movement. It's all about seeing your true nature. And it continues to be used in the present day, especially in Rinzai Zen, this term Kensho. And I think, unfortunately, as these teachings were translated into English, for some reason, I don't know who's responsible. If it was D.T. Suzuki, who was one of the early translators, or others. But often they leave Kensho untranslated for some reason. I don't think it's so skillful, because then it turns Kensho into this thing, like this mysterious noun. And they actually start using the word, and then he had Kensho, or he wanted to attain Kensho, or this thing that you attain or have, called Kensho. But Kensho means seeing nature. So if you translated it, he had seeing nature, it wouldn't make any sense. Seeing nature is a verb, right? It's something that is an experience of... I don't think it doesn't mean seeing through the eye. It means like perceiving or realizing, right? So to then turn seeing into this mysterious Japanese noun seems like, I don't know if it's so helpful. So I don't know why they didn't translate it. Maybe they thought it would sound too mundane to just say they saw their true nature. So instead they attained Kensho. Anyway, partly for some of these reasons, maybe, Dogen Zenji in the Soto tradition of Zen wasn't so fond of this word Kensho, even as a verb. And I understand it that he was so into non-duality. Dogen, this is like his main thing. Non-duality between practice and realization. Non-duality of Buddhas and sentient beings. Non-duality of self and other. Non-duality of mind and object. That was kind of his shtick. And to say seeing nature could imply a kind of some nature that is seen by someone. So I think Dogen felt like it could be kind of, the very term could be inherently understood dualistically. Whereas Satori literally means awakening or realizing, and gets translated as enlightenment. So I think we could also see that if recognizing your Buddha nature, getting a glimpse of your Buddha nature, seems to imply like a particular experience happening at a particular time and place, and then Satori could be seen more as like when that understanding of Buddha nature starts to pervade one's whole experience. Starts to develop some continuity in this new way of understanding. I think that's one way to distinguish. Kensho might be a little more temporary, and then when that's extended over time, we could call it Satori. There's some basis for looking at them like that. But they're sometimes used interchangeably, I think, too. And the Dogen maybe never uses the term Kensho, and it became more associated with Rinzai Zen. Dogen loves the term Satori. All through the Shobogenzo, I thought sometime when I turn the computer on, we can do a check of searching for that character in the Japanese Shobogenzo. My guess is that it's at least in the hundreds. And he uses this term, sho, or it's pronounced sho, or Satori. Also, Dogen, as I mentioned earlier, really likes, maybe even more, he likes this term. Did I say show? No, that's wrong. Go. Go, Ursatori. Dai Go is the name of his essay by Dogen. Go is the kind of Sino-Japanese way of reading it. Satori is the kind of traditional Japanese way of reading it. And Shou is this other character that means like confirmation or verification. And Dogen also likes that one. And Dogen also uses Kaku, which means awakening. So, Daigo, the name of this essay by Dogen, Great Awakening, Great Realization, is used all through the Zen tradition in like the transmission of light record. I know many of you know the stories of all our ancestors. I wouldn't say almost all of them, but maybe like most or many, many of our ancestors, there's a story, right? They have a dialogue with somebody and then they said he realized great awakening. That's always this term daigo. So great Satori is the term used all through the stories of our ancestors in the Denko Roku. There's a book here called Sounds of Valley Streams by Francis Cook and Enlightenment in Dogen Zen, subtitle, and it includes translations of this essay Daigo that we're exploring. But I really like Francis Cook's introductions. He's got a beautiful introduction to the transmission of light also. And this is just some excerpts because I think it's pertinent to what we've been talking about here. From his introduction, so essay he has called Being Awakened. He says, Buddhism is ultimately about enlightenment. Or awakening. He says, it does not primarily concern itself with morality, with being a good citizen, with conventional piety, or with confessing belief in a set of correct propositions. It does concern itself with these kinds of religiousness to some minor degree, but it's really about enlightenment. I don't know if I fully agree with him, but I think if he says Buddhism is really about that, and I think, you know, remember Buddha means awakened, so we could translate Buddhism as awakenism or enlightenmentism. Buddhism's kind of funny, right? It's a mix of Sanskrit and English. If we translate it all into English, we could say, the religion of enlightenmentism. And I'm an enlightenmentist. I'm an awakenist. So I think there's a lot more to awakenism than just awakening. Here he actually goes on to say, yet, having said this, it has to be acknowledged that for millions of Buddhists, living and dead, enlightenment is not, or has not been, the great goal of their lives. The popular Buddhism of laypersons in all cultures has been one of merit-making, done in the pious belief that this will ensure a rebirth in happy and fortunate circumstances. Enlightenment as a real option has seemed unrealistic for those who have no leisure for meditation and who feel caught up in the life of raising a family and struggling to survive. Buddhist cultures have made enlightenment contingent on a relatively high degree of asceticism and renunciation. So, we're going to hear some other sides of this story, but I think he's pretty accurate with my experience of Asian Buddhism. There's millions of Buddhists, lay people who are Buddhists, who are not really thinking about it. They know about Buddha's enlightenment, right? That's the beginning of their religion, but they're, it's not something that they think about for themselves. And even many monks in monasteries, it's just too far-reaching a goal. We've been talking in the past couple of days about these early Indian versions of enlightenment. It's, and it's, you know, it goes along with some degree of asceticism and renunciation. Francis Cook says, another reason for the rejection of enlightenment as a practical goal is that it's understood to be such a rare, extraordinary phenomena that even most monks, not to mention lay people, relinquish any hope of attaining it in the present life. Zen, this is, I think, kind of overall, you know, Asian Buddhism. I think it's somewhat true, at least some forms of Tibetan Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism. The final stages of awakening or Buddhahood is like, well, we wouldn't dare to think that we could realize such a thing in this lifetime. Even people who are doing it full-time their entire lives. We're on the path. You know. Zen starts to, I think, is the maybe main tradition that starts to look at it as something a little different, more accessible. Here he says, Francis Cook, one of the most interesting aspects of enlightenment or awakening, as Dogen presents it, is the way in which it's lost this aura of the otherworldly, the extraordinary, and the inaccessible. Dogen believed that it was attainable by anyone, lay people or monks, who made a serious effort, and he presents it in a remarkably demystified and demythologized way, which we've already started hearing about in Dogen's essay on Great Awakening. His attempt to bring enlightenment down out of the heavens, so to speak, and make it available to all persons is part of the great religious revolution that took place during the Kamakura period in Japan, and the reason why Dogen is ranked with Nichiren and Shinran as great popularizers of Buddhism. This is in the 1200s in Japan. There was this movement of, like, things have gotten too, like, removed from our actual life and our understanding of Buddhism, and it's become too elite and so on. So several people during Dogen's lifetime, different traditions of Buddhism, said, we have to find a new way of actually making this available to everybody, popularizing it. And Dogen was one of them. So Francis Cook goes on, this popularizing work may be evaluated in two ways. Let's see what you think. One way is to see it as a deviant, soft, watered-down version of authentic enlightenment, made attractive because it doesn't demand very much. It thus may be a bogus form of enlightenment, quite satisfying and impressive, but not the real thing. That's one version. Another way of evaluating it is to see Dogen as a realist who merely stripped away a kind of glorification and myth that had grown up around the achievement of Shakyamuni Buddha. Dogen could be correct in insisting that his version of enlightenment is the real, accurate version, and that myth, piety, and metaphysical excess had obscured the true nature of enlightenment over the centuries. Both of these interpretations can be supported, and I think are. Yes, that's right. Yes, Buddha did say this awakening is available to anyone. But then he kind of set the standard so high of his description of what it is. It is, I think, because it is possible for any human. But practically speaking, maybe very few are able to carry it out in the early version. And then, as I mentioned, the Mahayana Indian version in the sutras, got even, instead of getting less inaccessible, it got, I think, more, and it got more extravagant and awesome with these 10 bodhisattva bhumis leading up to Buddhahood. Even the first bodhisattva ground, if you read the descriptions in the Flower Ornament Sutra, it's already you're like pervading all different world systems with you know, simultaneously, just at the first bodhisattva stage, right? So, yes.
Isn't it possible that we are in fact doing that right now and we just aren't aware of it?
Could be. And Dogen might say such a thing. Yeah. Could be that it's possible right now. Like when we chant the Jiju Zamai, right, at noon service during Sesshin, it kind of sounds like pretty amazing that, like, at the moment of our Zazen, it's resonating with, like, all the Buddhas in the 10 directions, and it's renewing their Dharma bliss, and all the rocks, tiles, and pebbles are becoming enlightened through our Zazen, and in turn, they're enlightening us, right? And then Dogen says at the end of this exalted description of our Zazen, he says, but all this, however, doesn't appear within perception. Kind of like that, right? It's like, it may be happening, but we can't perceive it. So then Francis Cook goes on, I think that two suppositions characterize Indian views of enlightenment. I think it's really nice to know what the tradition says, right? That's what we've been doing the past couple of days. One characterization of Indian Buddhism and enlightenment is that the difference between an ordinary person and an enlightened person is the ordinary person is, he says, infected with a number of moral and cognitive flaws that need to be eradicated before enlightenment and liberation are possible. It's kind of, I think other Indian traditions are like this too. It's the gradual process of weakening and then ending greed, hate, and delusion. The second supposition regarding Indian Buddhism is that the individual is infected not just with greed, hate, and delusion, but a host of other kleshas or afflictions, not only numerous but tenacious and difficult to remove. For this reason, it's not realistic to expect to purify oneself of all these flaws in a single lifetime. So Indian Buddhists tended to believe that many lifetimes would be required. Enlightenment, at least perfect, complete enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha, awaits us thousands of lifetimes away, the to-be-hoped-for reward for our present diligence. Yeah. Not only that, but this attitude does not change with the Mahayana, despite teachings such as emptiness, which one would think would modify the traditional view. Enlightenment may be the sudden insight into the true nature of all things, including these klesha, or these afflictions, as empty. But this insight comes after a lengthy preliminary practice that stretches over countless lifetimes. That's the Mahayana model. This view is reflected in much Mahayana scriptural and treatise literature, some of which spells out the number of stages, as we've heard about. Yes?
It always struck me as kind of curious that people think they have an idea of how many lifetimes they've had or about to have.
That's a great point.
We just might be at that one.
That's right. That's right. I've sometimes wondered when they talk about even this thing of like enlightenment in a single lifetime, which Zen and other traditions talk about. Well, what do we mean by that? If we have the understanding of these multiple lifetimes, what about everything that came before? And so it's kind of funny to say that rather than it's taking a long time, but Shakyamuni Buddha, it says one lifetime, but then he tells about all these previous lifetimes where he was doing all this bodhisattva work. So it's a great point. When we start thinking about it, it becomes kind of strange. And yeah, we don't know. This could be, for all of us, this could be our last lifetime before Buddhahood, after many, many lifetimes of practice. Yep. That's another great point. Yep. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, Dogen definitely starts making this point about timelessness of enlightenment. And even the Mahayana Sutras, like this Parinirvana Sutra, there's implications in there of like this Buddha nature that we all share is like this potential for Buddhahood, but the something like because of timelessness and eternity, the potential is already realized, and yet it appears as if it still has to be played out. It's kind of hard to conceive of this issue of time and timelessness, yeah. So given all this Indian background, though, of this long, difficult process, Francis Cook says, in Chinese Zen, now, we encounter for the first time in Buddhism a belief that enlightenment is in some sense sudden in a way not found in Indian Buddhism. I say in some sense because in another sense both Indians and Chinese agree that enlightenment is by nature sudden. If enlightenment is a change in one's perception or understanding, then this change must occur in the blink of an eye rather than in increments as ordinary knowledge does. If enlightenment is the realization of an innate potential, perhaps understood as one's Buddha nature, then again, one either has or has not realized it, but there's no progress or partial realization. I think he's saying, even in Indian Buddhism, there's a pivotal moment. The evidence seems to indicate that by sudden, the Chinese simply meant that enlightenment does not have to be preceded by lengthy stages of moral and cognitive self-purification. They were thus essentially adopting an antinomian stance in opposition to a more moralistic position held by the Indian Buddhists. By antinomian, I mean a religious doctrine holding that salvation or liberation is not contingent on moral status. Does anyone know that word antinomian? That's at least how he's defining it. It's interesting because I hope he's not implying that it has nothing to do with morality, that enlightenment doesn't. Of course, it does, and it's a great danger in trying to separate them. But like Dogen Zen he emphasizes morality and bodhisattva precepts a lot. But when we look into Dogen, and our Soto Zen tradition often implies that it's like through this understanding of Buddha nature, the precepts are kept. They're even called Buddha nature precepts in the Brahmajala Sutra. They're like the way our true nature is from the point of view of non-separation. We don't harm others. We don't see others to harm, and therefore we don't harm them. Or we don't try to get something from them or from the world. But I think this thing about all this kind of karmic purification up to enlightenment, that's the Indian model, seems to be, he's saying the Chinese Zen tradition says, you can realize this, you know, as a woodcutter walking through the marketplace, hearing a line of sutra, and you can see your true nature. And then you can start aligning your moral life with your understanding. It's not like it's not part of the issue, but it's more like you can have this realization without having completely purified all your flaws. The Chinese, he says, were insisting that enlightenment could occur, at least theoretically, without any kind of preparatory work so strenuously held by Indian Buddhist texts. The basic question for Chinese Buddhists was, does enlightenment have to be linked with a kind of previous moral uprightness? And does one have to wait for a very long time to change from an ordinary person to a Buddha? They said no. This is Francis Cook's take on this. The Chinese could back up their belief by appealing to the undeniable authority of a sutra like the Vimalakirti Sutra, which says, one attains nirvana without destroying the moral and cognitive klesha, these afflictions. So there's Mahayana sutras were already talking this way, and the in that Parinirvana Sutra we've been studying, I didn't bring out this line, but it's one of those radical non-duality lines in this third century sutra. But it's all about Buddha nature. The Buddha says, all the bondages of ignorance, avidya, and defilements, klesha, are Buddha nature. He says it, the Buddha in the Parinirvana Sutra. After talking about how the Buddha nature is totally pure and eternal and free from all conditioned phenomena, this is kind of like later, near the end of the sutra. He's saying all these appearances of the ignorance and afflictions are themselves Buddha nature. Why? The way I would interpret this is because sentient beings are themselves Buddha nature. Sentient beings are just a package of ignorance and affliction. Kind of what we sentient beings are. But the true nature of all that is Buddha nature. Those things, those afflictions and deluded thoughts and confusions are arising and ceasing in the big space of Buddha nature as Buddha nature. Sutra doesn't say it exactly like that, but... So Dogen, in his essay, Daigo, Great Satori.
Was that an introduction to Daigo?
That's Francis Cook's introduction to this book that includes 9 Shobogenzo essays, including Daigo. Yeah. That he chose particularly about awakening or enlightenment from Dogen's teachings. So, Dogen says, great master Hui Zhao of Linji Temple. Linji in Japanese, his name is Rinzai. Oh, you know, it's another school of Zen, but Linji is also one of our ancestors. On the lineage charts that you receive when you receive the precepts, it includes both Soto and Rinzai lineages that come together at Dogen, who received both. We emphasize more our Soto side. So Linji said, in the land of great Tang Dynasty, China, it's hard to find a single person who isn't awakened. In the land of all of great China, it's hard to find a single person who isn't awakened. Pretty different from the Indian story, huh? Where it's hard to find a single person who is awakened. What Dogen says, commenting, what the great master Hui Jiao, Lin Ji, says here is the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow passed down through the main artery of the Zen lineage. It could not be false. In the land of Great China means the eyeball of the self. Jikko Ganze. The all-seeing eye of the true self. Dogen has a whole essay called Ganze, or eyeball, which is another one of his names for awakening or Buddha mind. And he talks also about the true self, the radiant light of the true self, this Jikko. So another name for awakened nature. The eyeball with no edges. The eyeball that's not limited by any kind of circumference or fleshy edges. The eyeball of the true self.
Seeing,
But in this case, it's not like seeing something, because what he says is that the land of Great China means the eyeball of the true self. It's not that Great China is seen by the eyeball of the true self. The land of Great China is the eyeball of the self. When we're looking out across the great land of China, this, what we're looking at is the eyeball of the true self. Now, this is Dogen Zen, right? Commenting on this not so, already kind of radical line of Lin Ji, saying in the land of Great China, it's hard to find a single person who isn't awakened. But Dogen goes far beyond, right? First, let's take up Great China. Land of Great China means the eyeball of the self. It's not limited within any realm like China or India or Japan or America. It's not confined to lands numerous as dust motes. Here, this eyeball of the true self, here it is hard to find a single person who's not awakened. Yesterday's self of one's own self is not one who is not awakened.
The conventional self is true nature, all-pervading true self.
Could say it like that. And I think in this case, yesterday's self, I think, might be implying, today I now see for the first time this is a great awakening. But yesterday's self was totally deluded. Before this moment of understanding, yesterday's self was not awakened. But Dogen says, yesterday's self of one's own true self is not one who's not awakened.
And,
Zen loves those double negatives. Because, double negatives are, serve a nice function. Because it's like, it's not positing anything that we can kind of get a hold of. It's just saying, it's not awakened. It's a little safer to speak that way. Yes. It shines everywhere.
And it shines everywhere. Don't enclose it. Become what you already are. And I would agree with where Dogen, or the idea of everyone is already that.
And Dogen might even say, the basket too is the light.
Ah.
yesterday's self of one's own self is not one who's not awakened. Today's self of another self is not one who's not awakened. I think it's playing with this idea of the big self. So yesterday's small self of our true self is not one who's not awakened. Today's true self of another separate self is not one who's not awakened. You could hear it like this. Searching through the past and present of the people of mountains and people of waters, I think this just means people everywhere, the unawakened cannot be found. Students who study Linji's saying in this way will not pass their days and nights in vain. So this is a quote from Sherto's Merging of Difference and Unity. We translate it as, don't waste time. So he quotes that little line. If those who study Linji's saying in this way will not waste time. Well, so he basically agrees with Linji here, but now he's going to bring up some other issues. Dogen says, well, this may be so. We should nevertheless go on to study the inner deeds of the ancestral lineage. That is, we should question Linji a little bit. Here's the first question. To know only that it's hard to find someone who isn't awakened without knowing that it's hard to find someone who is awakened is not enough to be right. It's hard to say that you have fully investigated even your own statement, Linji, that it's hard to find someone who isn't awakened. So I would take this here to be, it's hard to find someone who isn't awakened. It's hard to find a single person who isn't awakened. And Dogen says, it's hard to find a single person who is awakened. And I think that's because it's hard to find a single person, period. So we can't find one that's not awakened, but we can't find a single person who is awakened. Although it may be hard to find a single person who's not awakened, there is a half a person who's not awakened. His countenance is calm and his bearing majestic. Have you ever seen him? Do you not think that your difficulty in finding a single person who's not awakened in the land of Great China is the final word? So this half a person. I think here Dogen's playing with this idea of going beyond awakening. In the first sentences of this essay, he says, you know, the Buddhas and ancestors are those who take up awakening and have no awakening, and so on. And no awakening is sometimes used in this positive sense of, like, beyond any idea of awakening. They don't even have something we could call awakening. So it's kind of like, looking at it from that point of view, then it might be hard to find a single person who's not awakened. There is a half a person who's not awakened. We could say a half a person that goes beyond awakening with calm countenance and majestic bearing. So that's a second point he'd kind of critique Linji on. And the third point is, you should try to find two or three lands of Great China within a single person or half a person. So, remember the original statement is, it's hard to find a single person who's not awakened in the Great Land of China. But Dogen says, you should try to find two or three lands of Great China within a single person or half a person. Are they hard to find or not hard to find? When you're equipped with this eye, I will accept you as a Buddha and ancestor who has studied her fill. So I would take that as kind of like he already said that the land of Great China is the eyeball of the self. So we should try to find the great land of China within a single person or within a half a person, rather than find a person within the land of China. Because this awakened person includes everything within herself, including the whole land of China and Santa Cruz, rather than Santa Cruz includes a bunch of awakened or unawakened people. The self includes all lands, rather than lands include the self, the person, or half a person. Half a person might be like, well, maybe we can find, if we can't find one person who's gone beyond any idea of awakening, at least we can find half a person. Or we could say, half of them has gone beyond awakening. And the other half is thinking, cool, awakening, or even is awakened, but notices their awakening. As Dogen says, Buddhas do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. So I could say, half the Buddha doesn't necessarily notice that they're a Buddha, and the other half of a Buddha says, I alone am the world-honored one. Like they kind of notice. Say, I alone, including all beings throughout the eyeball of the self, am the world-honored one. Baby Buddha, yeah.
It was either the baby Buddha on his birth or the, you know, whatever he said on enlightenment.
That's right, both. He uses this word I, which is, luckily for those of us who've been in this class this fall about the true self, we can be relieved now about this word I, using this very large, all-inclusive sense. And there's a beautiful essay by Kazan Zenji, our ancestor, in The Transmission of Light, where Buddha says, I, together with the great earth and all beings, attain the way on this day of Rohatsu. And then Kazan goes on to say, we have to investigate this I that the Buddha said. This I is, pervades all places, and all of us right now are included within the I, together with all beings that realizes the Buddha way. Shakyamuni Buddha's I includes all of us, both his eyeball and his self. Now I can forget all about great enlightenment for the rest of the day. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.